This time on your weekly Constitutional, let's talk about the parade of high federal officials defying the president to testify before Congress.
People are having to decide where to draw the line. Now, most federal employees have civil service protection. They can raise that if they were to be retaliated against, although that's sort of small comfort if you lose your job. So I think, you know, in most of these cases, these are genuine public servants and patriots who feel like they need to step forward and do the right thing.
That was former federal prosecutor Benjamin Vernia talking about the Ukraine impeachment inquiry. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's about defying the president.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Benjamin Vernia is an old buddy of mine, and he's also a lawyer in Washington, D.C., where, among other things, he represents federal whistleblowers. In his former life, he was a prosecutor for the Department of Justice, and so he's seen a lot of federal proceedings from both sides. I can think of no better person on the date of this interview, October 29th, 2019, to tell us about the parade of high-ranking federal officials who are testifying before Congress in defiance of the president. So, Ben Vernia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Last time you were on, we were talking about all Mueller all the time. So I guess it's appropriate for us to pick up where we left off. What's the last we've heard about the Mueller report?
Well, the Mueller report, was issued, time flies, was it earlier this year? I think it was March of this year. Probably the most recent thing that has come up with the Mueller report is that the House Judiciary Committee issued a subpoena, or actually demanded of the Department of Justice that they provide some grand jury information, not all of the grand jury information prepared by the Mueller team, but some of it. And just recently, Judge Beryl Howell in the District of Columbia issued an order granting that motion to produce and basically ordering the Department of Justice to turn over some grand jury information from the Mueller investigation to the House Judiciary Committee.
Now, normally as a baseline, rule, grand jury information is not something that's disclosed because of the sanctity of the grand jury process. Could you talk about that baseline consideration and why the judge decided not to go with that rule this time?
Yeah, let me first start with a little bit of sort of history on the grand jury secrecy issue. We America, imported the grand jury system through the common law of England, where grand jury proceedings were secret as well. And there's a number of concerns that motivated grand jury secrecy. A lot of them have to do really with the sort of the safety of witnesses and the desire not to tip off a suspect that they're being investigated for crime. You know, so those are sort of all relevant to the pre-indictment stage of an investigation. You know, obviously you don't want someone who's possibly accused or suspected of a violent criminal act knowing that, you know, a person has testified against them before the grand jury, you know, while they're still, walking around free and able to possibly intimidate that witness or harm them. So that's one of the main motivations. There was also the concern that if a grand jury were to return a no bill or not even seek an indictment, the prosecutor was not even to seek an indictment, there would be some taint to the reputation of innocent persons.
Right.
Just because of things that happened in the grand jury.
Let's go back even one more step. This is not the same sort of jury we see on Law and Order. This is not a Pettit jury that hears a particular case. This is a group of people who are there in some sense to assist or perhaps to some extent check a prosecutor and to make sure that prosecutors only accuse or indict people based upon adequate evidence, right?
That's right. Historically, grand jurors were very involved in the investigation of crime. That has become less and less true. You know, there's a common statement now that you know, that you could get a prosecutor could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that's exactly true, but there's essentially two uses of the grand jury. One is simply to present an indictment and some basic evidence to support it and get that approved. And those happen all the time. But another more substantive use is really to use them as an investigative tool. And in some cases, I assume, including the Mueller case, there will be a special grand jury that is impaneled solely to do that investigation. In other cases, you know, a prosecutor will basically use a normal grand jury that is used for other purposes. They'll simply continue using that grand jury, some part of that grand jury's time to work on a lengthy investigation.
And so a grand jury can, for example, issue subpoenas?
The grand jury can issue subpoenas. A lot of times the prosecutors will, depending on local custom and rule, the prosecutor will have the authority to do that on behalf of the grand jury.
Right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, since I've never prosecuted. You don't have to. There's no constitutional requirement of a grand jury, is there? I mean, some prosecutors can just go out and file charges on their own, often calling it an information rather than an indictment. Why is that? Why is that we have these different ways that prosecutors can initiate a case?
Well, there is a constitutional requirement at the federal level that felony charges be brought by indictment.
Okay, excuse me, but not at the state level.
Yeah, I believe that's true. I work mostly with the federal system.
Right.
The different charging instruments that can happen, they're sort of they're used in different situations. The most basic one is what's called a criminal complaint. That's when you really have essentially what amounts to an emergency situation where a law enforcement officer can simply file a criminal complaint, which would allow them to seize a suspect. But those criminal complaints are used only essentially for the purpose of arrest. They're not charging instruments in the sense that they would go forward into the criminal case itself. The other two methods are the indictment, which we've just talked about, which has to be returned by a majority of the grand jury, and a criminal information, which is essentially an indictment but is not voted on by a grand jury. And that only happens in situations where the defendant has waived their right in writing to a grand jury. Most often that happens in the case of plea discussions where the prosecutor and the defense counsel have reached an agreement as to what charge will be filed and how it will be disposed of.
Okay, that helps clarify it. And as we said before, the procedures at the state level may be different, and that's a little bit beyond the scope of our discussion right now. Okay, so for all these reasons, and certainly because of the constitutional requirement, grand juries are important. And secrecy is important, both to protect the accused and to protect witnesses. And that brings us back to the Mueller situation. There were criminal cases that grew out of the Mueller investigation, and so there were grand juries that were impaneled. And so there was testimony and other information generated by those investigations, and that is what Congress has been seeking and what the administration has been resisting, right?
Right. Congress has sought, the House Judiciary Committee has sought not the entire grand jury file, but specific categories of information. Primarily, sort of first and foremost among those were information that was redacted from the Mueller report before the Mueller report was forwarded to Congress by the Justice Department.
Right. So obviously something that's highly relevant to what Congress is doing, but also something generated in a grand jury. And so it went to a judge. And as you said, the judge basically sided with Congress, and in doing so made a very important finding about the nature of what Congress was doing. Could you explain that?
Sure. Judge Howell basically was looking at two separate grounds for turning over grand jury information. And one of them, which I won't talk about very much, was called inherent authority. And that is essentially the idea that any presiding judge presiding over a grand jury has the inherent power of releasing grand jury information. And that avenue was foreclosed in the case before Judge Howell, but by a decision of the D.C. Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals sitting above her, in a different case called McKeever, also this year, unrelated to the Mueller report or President Trump or anything like that. So she really focused instead on the text of Rule 6E. And 6E, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E, is the grand jury secrecy provision. It has its primarily its primary purpose is to protect grand jury secrets, but it does have a number of exceptions, including exceptions for proceedings in a judicial proceeding. And Judge Howell basically, you know, reasoned that the House Judiciary Committee hearings were judicial proceedings, that they'd showed a particularized need for the evidence, and so therefore they should get it under Rule 6E, so under an existing exception to grand jury secrecy.
Yep, and in so holding, she essentially agreed with the position of the House Democrats that this is an impeachment inquiry, regardless of the fact that they haven't had a formal vote on whether to initiate such an inquiry.
That's right.
And that, of course, is an extremely important point of contention between the Republicans and the Democrats right now. So this was a two-part victory for the Democrats. Probably will be appealed to the D.C. Circuit, don't you think?
It already has been.
Yeah, okay. that's pretty much
actually,
a given.
There was a motion to stay Judge Howell's order pending that appeal. I think the last brief on that was due 2.5 hours ago or so. So
you're right up to the minute here, Ben. We called the right guy, obviously. You got your finger on the pulse here.
It's proceeding at everything in these cases is proceeding very quickly.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have like a website that just basically showed you like the status of all this.
Minute by minute status. You should do that in your spare time. You should start such a website. I should mention that this is, we're speaking today on Tuesday, October the 29th of 2019. And though I don't typically give date stamps for these shows because we like to say that we're topical but not necessarily breaking news on this show. This, by its very nature, this inquiry is all breaking news here in the fall of 2019. And so just for people's reference, that's when we're talking and everything could change later today. Okay. So that's where we are on Mueller. So, so far so good for the Democrats, but that could all change with another judicial decision. And certainly the appeals will probably go all the way to the Supreme Court on that one. Anything else happening on Mueller lately?
I'm sure there is. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing. Is there something else that you...
No, I was actually thinking most of the stuff I've been seeing has been ancillary to Mueller. Mueller, has been our focus, yours and mine, up till recently. And then, of course, there are other lawsuits pending against Trump, and one of them is a criminal investigation by the Attorney General of New York. And I don't know exactly what the allegations are there. I think some sort of improper use of money by the Trump charities or something of that sort. And as part of their investigation, the prosecutors there want his tax returns going back, I think it's something like 8 years. And he's been resisting giving them to the prosecutors in New York. And recently, they won a victory, didn't they?
Yeah, there's actually, the prosecutors won a victory before District Judge Marrero in the Southern District of New York. The prosecutor in this case is Cyrus Vance, who is the district attorney of the County of New York, which is... includes Manhattan, but it's one of two cases involving the Trump Organization's longtime accountant company, Mazars USA.
Uh-huh.
And essentially what Cyrus Vance did was subpoena the tax returns. And I think the backstory on this is that they all relate to, or the primary motivation for the investigation are the payments that Michael Cohen made on Donald Trump's behalf to the adult film star,
that's right,
Stormy Daniels, and how those payments were characterized on the books and records of the Trump Organization. That's sort of the main issue for Cyrus Vance is whether those records of the business were falsified. The business is incorporated, as I understand it, in the state of New York, and so the state of New York also has a tax collecting agency, has some interest in the books and records of companies in its jurisdiction being accurate. And if there was, falsification in the books and records of the Trump Organization as to those payments or what they were for, whether they were deducted as business expenses, that sort of thing, that's all relevant to the state of New York.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing is when people do embarrassing things or perhaps illegal things, oftentimes what gets them in trouble is trying to hide those things in their books. because then that changes the tax consequences. So in some sense, this is just a tax case. It'll be very interesting. In fact, I think that one was also appealed immediately to the Second Circuit, wasn't it? And they just recently had oral arguments, which were striking, just striking. What happened during those oral arguments?
Yeah, the oral arguments, as I recall, were on the 23rd. Donald Trump's attorney took the extraordinary position that that the sitting president cannot be investigated for a criminal act. And I think it was one of the Second Circuit judges asked him, what if using Mr. Trump's own analogy, he were to go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone, could the city, New York City Police Department investigate him for that? And Donald Trump's lawyer said no.
Right.
And I think, Judge Marrero's opinion in that case begins really with the sentence, "The president asserts an extraordinary claim in this dispute now before this court," which is never the kind of thing you want to read early on in an opinion, because it kind of suggests that actually the judge is not buying your argument.
Well, I remember reading the account of that oral argument and the judge asking almost incredulously in the Second Circuit, "Is that your argument?" And the counsel for the president saying, "Yes, that's it. That's exactly what we're arguing." And I was reminded of something that happened to me as a law student. I was in our moot court class, and I followed my own argument to a logical extreme. And so, of course, the professor just led me straight down the garden path until I was asserting an absurdity. And I remember him looking at me incredulously and saying, "Is that your position, Mr. Harris?" And I thought about it. I said, "Well, yeah, I guess it is." And, of course, I was roundly criticized for that. I mean, sometimes, pure logic will lead you in a certain direction. But as my professor told me, it's up to you as the advocate to find a reasonable stopping point. Okay? Yeah, I can see your point, Your Honor. I can see how you might think that. But no, a rule of reason would tell us that we wouldn't go that far. And here's why we wouldn't go that far. With all due respect to this lawyer, the court just let him down the garden path, and he asserted an extreme argument. And it seems to me almost impossible that the Second Circuit can uphold that, because then, literally Donald Trump could walk around murdering people on the street and nobody could even investigate him, let alone charge him.
Yeah, I think it's never a good idea to lubricate the slippery slope.
I think that's exactly what they did. It's a Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is former federal prosecutor Benjamin Vernia, who's telling us all about this Mueller investigation and this Ukraine investigation and the dilemmas faced by the witnesses parading before Congress. Stick around. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. My guest is Benjamin Vernia, former federal prosecutor and a current D.C. lawyer who sometimes represents whistleblowers, federal whistleblowers. Before the break, we were talking about one of the many cases pending against our current president, specifically the one filed by the Attorney General in New York, who is seeking the president's tax records. And the interesting arguments that the president's lawyers have been making, which essentially say he can't be investigated for anything while he's president. And this is such an extreme argument that, I don't know if it's going to fly. I guess I'll go out on a limb here and predict the Second Circuit is going to uphold Judge Marrero on this one. And then, of course, that'll be appealed to the Supremes, and we will see what happens on that one. But so far, at least, there is an order out there that's been stayed for Mazars to give Donald Trump's tax returns to the Attorney General. And then we'll see what happens. I mean, the question then becomes if the Attorney General in New York gets these, and he is a Democrat, and, will there be some sort of order, in some sense, segregating those things or prohibiting him from publicly revealing them? And will that be effective? Because, of course, I think that's at least part of the political motivation of the president, is that he doesn't want those things out there publicly scrutinized.
Yeah, that seems to be the case, notwithstanding his statements that he would love to have people see them. But I think, that the tactic, I think, was certainly going to backfire in the Second Circuit, or at least I hope it would. But the other problem for them, frankly, is how that will make the Supreme Court look at their petition for certiorari if and when they lose in the Second Circuit. I think taking an extreme position like that may actually make the court less likely to take the case on cert.
Right, and if they do that, effectively that affirms the Second Circuit, and then the order would go into effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, that would be a very easy way for the court to sidestep this whole issue, is to say that the president has asserted such an extreme position, we're just not even going to hear the case. And of course, they don't even have to give a reason for if they deny cert. They just deny it. And
there's a agreement, essentially, regarding the stay in that case. That Vance and Trump's attorneys have agreed that the stay would remain in place as long as if the Trump organization were to lose the argument or lose in the Second Circuit, they would petition for cert within a few, I think it's like 10 days or something.
Uh-huh.
So basically, they're on a fast track to at least petition for certiorari. And then I think that, it would be up to the Supreme Court whether they hear it or not.
And as you said before, this is moving at lightning speed. Typically, the process of petitioning for cert is a lengthy and difficult and extremely expensive process. My wife participated in one such petition years ago, and the amount of work they put into it, and that's just asking the court to hear your case, was absolutely extraordinary. And of course, the court can take its time in responding. So this reminds me of the New York versus United States case, the Pentagon Papers case back in the early 70s. The whole case was taken care of in about 3 weeks. And that's that's the fastest case I can remember the Supreme Court hearing. But we seem to be in a similarly fast track with a number of these Trump cases. So, stay tuned on that one.
U.S. versus Nixon was about 2 months, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and when you're talking about high-profile players, when you're talking about the fate of the nation, when you're talking about the institutions of government, or when you're talking about something like, free speech and the First Amendment in the New York Times, the courts just basically say, okay, put it at the top of the docket, and everybody else waits. Which brings us, of course, to the issue of the day, which seems to a great extent to have eclipsed everything else that's going on with Trump and with the Mueller report and all the rest of it, and that, of course, is Ukraine. Just recap to us, what exactly happened here? What happened, and why is it so important?
Well, I think that the main event that happened was the July 25th telephone call between the president and the president of the United States and the president of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky, at which the question of U.S. foreign military assistance, which had been already appropriated by Congress, was discussed. And in the transcript of that call as released by the White House, Donald Trump basically said, "Do me a favor first, okay?" And then referred to two requests, one relating to announcing an investigation about presidential candidate Joe Biden's son, Hunter, and his connections to a Ukrainian natural gas firm, Burisma. And the other had to do with something, servers.
The idea that there was a physical server, computer, upon which Hillary Clinton's emails were, and that in the wake of their hacking by persons unknown, this particular box was taken, I guess, under cover of darkness to, of all places, Ukraine, where it can still be found, perhaps, I don't know, in an underground bunker someplace. And that's what he wanted to find out, because I think the president's contention is that it was not the Russians, after all, who hacked the DNC servers. It was the Ukrainians, which, of course, would support his narrative that he wasn't assisted by the Russians and didn't collude with the Russians leading up to 2016. The fact of the matter is, though, that there was no single box computer in which these emails were resident. They were actually in several different servers, and they were also backed up in the cloud, weren't they?
Yeah, my understanding is that they were using Amazon Web Services to provide the email server. And under AWS, basically, you have what's called virtual computing. So there's really no central box in which any given process or its data can be located. And I understand that the FBI actually obtained copies of the various different actual servers on which this process and its data were spread out. So not only was it not on one server, but also the FBI long ago obtained all the data that there is to obtain about it.
Okay. So apparently, according to the transcript, and of course, it's subject to interpretation, but a lot of people say that it's looks like a fairly straightforward quid pro quo. But the quid pro quo is not necessary, is it? I mean, the president, if he was in fact simply soliciting assistance of any kind from a foreign power in an American election, that was a criminal violation of the campaign finance rules, wasn't it?
That is the position taken by the Federal Election Commission chairwoman. I think it's supported in federal case law. There's a number of specific federal crimes that could come into play here. There's bribery. There is the FEC violation. There's also a crime called conversion. There's a number that you could find, or you could simply say that it was, an abuse of power, which is sort of akin to, one of the articles of impeachment that was brought against Richard Nixon.
Exactly. It's important to remember that if you're talking about impeachment, and after all, this is an impeachment inquiry, that the impeachable offense is whatever the House of Representatives says it is. And as you point out, in the past, simply abusing power of the presidency has been a ground for impeachment. In fact, if you go back, I believe, to Federalist 65, where the debates in the Constitution, you will see that Alexander Hamilton and others talked about that as a basis for impeaching a president. So we don't have to have a crime. But if you want a crime, you can point to the campaign finance law violation. And if you want a further crime, if you believe there was a quid pro quo, then in some sense that goes beyond bribery. It goes to extortion. You have the president of the United States extorting a foreign power to do something to help him politically. And then, of course, as you say, there's the argument of conversion, because he's extorting him by withholding not his own money, but money that's been appropriated by Congress for the defense of Ukraine.
Right. He's basically using federal property for his personal purposes.
Right. And that, in the legal term, that is conversion, taking somebody else's property for your own. So there's just a whole host of bases in this exchange that could serve as the basis for an impeachable offense. Now, of course, in fairness, let's say that the president denies it. He's more or less chanting now, no quid pro quo. Of course, his opponents are chanting, quid pro quo, Trump must go. So that does seem to be the focus of a lot of the debate here. Going beyond the transcript, and by the way, we should acknowledge that this is a redacted transcript, so we have not seen a complete transcript. In fact, some of the redactions are indicated by ellipses during which the president was apparently speaking. So it looks like these could be some very significant redactions. There's another issue to find out what those documents are, and I believe Congress has asked for those documents, and the president has refused to cooperate. That brings us closer to the present day. In fact, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the fact that the president has simply declared that he will not cooperate with this investigation. He claims it's somehow unconstitutional. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, on October 8th, the president's counsel, Pat Cipollone, I think I'm pronouncing that right, sent a letter to Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, and their Republican counterparts, essentially saying that the inquiry that was underway in the House of Representatives was illegitimate and that the administration simply would not participate in it any longer. And they make a number, Cipollone's letter's been criticized a lot online by lawyers. He makes several key points, I think all of which are pretty easily rebutted. The first one really relates to the rights that the House is allegedly depriving the president of, and how it is settled law that the criminal defendants or defendants in the U.S. are entitled to those rights, and he greatly overstates the rights available to targets of investigation and criminal defendants. I think any criminal defense lawyer would read this and would simply not recognize what he's saying as actually what happens, in the majority of cases in the criminal system in the U.S.
Let's pause there. We just talked about grand jury proceedings. Grand juries are convened in secret for the prosecutor to present to them what evidence the prosecutor has at that point in making a charging decision, prior to making that decision. That's kind of where we are with the House of Representatives, right? I mean, they're interviewing witnesses, they're taking depositions, they're getting these facts down on paper so that the stories won't be coordinated or changed later, so that the witnesses, at least in theory, aren't talking to one another. And during this period where they're simply gathering evidence and to decide whether to indict, or in the case of Congress, to impeach, that's not something in which defendants participate, is it?
Not at all during the investigative stage. Defendants, again, let me focus on the federal system. The defendants' rights during an investigation are very limited, and they are mostly the few rights they have are circumscribed really by the prosecution's own judgment. One of the few rights that a criminal defendant, you know, can exercise would be to insist to go before a grand jury to offer their side of the story. Almost no criminal defendant ever does that, simply because it would be ineffective and it would create a record that they would probably have brought up against them at trial. It's essentially the Miranda issue. Mm-hmm. You don't want to speak before you have to. But Cipollone describes, you know, the procedures that he thinks should be required, including the right to see all evidence, to present evidence, to call witnesses, to have counsel present, to cross-examine witnesses, to make objections about examination. None of that exists in the investigative stage, certainly in the federal system, and I'm pretty sure in most state systems.
No, that's the sort of stuff you do at trial.
Exactly right.
You know, after the charges have been brought, you know, after the, well, I mean, basically at trial, okay, and then the period leading up to trial, after there's been an actual indictment, is when those sorts of rights kick in. And they have not been afforded to previous presidents who have been impeached, except as the House of Representatives decided to do so. I think they gave some limited ability in the Clinton impeachment for the president to participate in some sense relatively early on. But there's no requirement for them to do that, is there?
No, there isn't. And I think if you look at Clinton, for example, that in that case, you know, Ken Starr had a lengthy investigation and made a lengthy submission to Congress about his team's findings and the evidence that supported them. So really, that was more akin to Mueller. I mean, that was essentially an outsourced, an executive branch run investigation that was then handed over to Congress. In this case, you're really talking about facts that are developing really since, you know, this summer. And Congress is really the first and the only entity to investigate it. So it's not like they can benefit from this existing work that had already been done.
Indeed. All right. So that seems to be a bit of an overreach. What else did Cipollone assert?
The other claim that Cipollone makes, which I think is easily refuted, is that the House inquiry is constitutionally invalid because it hasn't been launched by a majority vote of the House. And I think if you go back, I'm not so sure about Clinton, but certainly in the Nixon impeachment proceedings, the Senate conducted an investigation. The House launched its investigation following the Saturday Night Massacre in October of 73, really simply by a referral from the Speaker to Peter Rodino, who was the House Judiciary Committee chair at the time. It did not launch a formal impeachment investigation or an impeachment inquiry until January or so of 74.
So there were a number of months there. There were a number of months there where there were investigations going on without any formal vote on that by the House.
Exactly. And they were understood to be related to the impeachment or potential impeachment of the president. I think the Senate Select Committee, which was referred to as the Senate Watergate Committee, that was the one with Sam Ervin and Howard mm-hmm. Baker. They had a number of closed-door sessions. They also had a number of open-door sessions. That was certainly not, you know, voted on in the sense that, you know, the House didn't participate at all in that. The House committee, again, there was not a formal resolution to transfer those impeachment resolutions from the Speaker to the Judiciary Committee. in the fall of 73.
The impeachment inquiry.
Impeachment. This impeachment inquiry.
A criminal probe.
The impeachment inquiry into President Donald
the
Trump.
The impeachment investigation.
Impeachment.
Impeachment.
The impeachment inquiry.
Do you have any idea how low this president is prepared to sink?
A criminal probe.
We've long abandoned the practice of asking where the bottom is for Donald Trump and his supporters in Congress.
Hey, it's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a rollicking conversation with my old buddy Ben Vernia, who's practiced law in D.C. for a number of years, and before that was a federal prosecutor. And we have been talking about the president's position that the current impeachment inquiry is invalid because there has not been a formal vote on to open such an inquiry. And we'll talk more about it after the break. And now it's time to finish our discussion with former federal prosecutor Benjamin Vernia. Just before the break, we were talking about the Nixon impeachment inquiry and the fact that it went on both in the Senate and the House for a number of months before there was an actual vote to open a formal impeachment inquiry. And indeed, it was simply part of the regular oversight duties of the Congress. And so current arguments that the inquiry by the House against President Trump are constitutionally invalid, well, they don't seem to have much constitutional basis. Okay, so we've been down this road before, and moreover, we should say that Article 1 of the Constitution not only gives the sole power of impeachment to the House, it gives the sole power of running itself, of making its own rules to the House, as it does to the Senate, and that typically when someone files a court challenge to something that the House has decided to do as a procedural matter, that gets rejected by the courts. The courts will say, no, this is something that is specifically left to the House of Representatives, and we are not going to find this justiciable. We're not going to take this case. And so that, again, that struck me as being very strange by Mr. Cipollone to assert. This blanket refusal by the administration has been cited by Nancy Pelosi and by Adam Schiff as further evidence of obstruction. They're saying that just as you tried to obstruct the Russian collusion investigation, just as was outlined in the Mueller report in 10 or 12 separate instances, just as you have tried to obstruct our investigation in specific ways, this blanket refusal to cooperate with a co-equal branch of government is further evidence that you are trying to obstruct our investigation. That's pretty much the definition of obstruction, isn't it? It's getting in the way of an official investigation.
It certainly is, and the Trump administration has gone far beyond even what the Nixon administration did to obstruct, and that was one of the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon that was voted out of the House. So it's hard to imagine that the House Intelligence Committee or whoever ends up voting articles of impeachment to the floor will not include obstruction. It's really rather breathtaking what they've been doing here.
Yeah, it is. In fact, you mentioned a moment ago the Saturday Night Massacre, which our, shall I say, more seasoned listeners will remember. But that was where Nixon essentially, well, he did. He ordered his subordinates to fire the special Watergate prosecutor. I think it was Archibald Cox, right?
Right.
And he and his subordinates refused. His attorney general, Elliot Richardson, refused. The assistant attorney general, William Ruckelshaus, refused. And they both resigned. And finally they got down to a fellow by the name of Bork, Robert Bork, who later became notorious for being rejected for the Supreme Court. And he fired him. And it was that very aggressive attack on the investigation that I think led the House to include in its articles, its draft articles of impeachment, the obstruction of the investigation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think, you know, Nixon also vigorously opposed, really up until a month or two before his resignation, you know, releasing the tapes from inside the Oval Office.
Right.
And, you know, probably the worst was the smoking gun tape, which exposed that he had asked his underlings to basically tell the FBI to stop investigating the Watergate break-in.
Exactly. Okay, and that was enough to basically send the signal. Yeah, signal came from Capitol Hill to the president, you're going to be impeached and you're going to be removed, and that's when he decided to resign. Well, that brings us up more or less to the present day. We've had a series, we've had the president say, I'm not cooperating, I'm instructing my subordinates not to go. And one would think, well, that ends it. I mean, he's the head of the executive branch. Certainly he's the commander-in-chief of the military. And therefore his subordinates are supposed to salute figuratively or literally and say, yes, sir, and do what he says. And yet we have seen a parade, not only of former, but of current administration officials agree to testify, agree to honor the subpoenas they've been served with, and go testify with increasing damage to the president over the course of the past couple of weeks. And it's continuing even today as we speak. How are these people getting away with this? How are they navigating a subpoena from Congress on one hand and a command from the president on the other?
Well, it's, you know, with great courage. I mean, it's very difficult for these people. And I've represented whistleblowers in federal investigations. People are, you know, having to decide, you know, where to draw the line. Now, most federal employees have civil service protection. They can raise that if they were to be retaliated against, although that's sort of small comfort, you know, if you lose your job or have your responsibilities dramatically reduced. So I think, you know, in most of these cases, these are genuine public servants and patriots who feel like they need to, you know, step forward and do the right thing. I think that there is sort of this notion that executive privilege and, you know, the executive's right to ask an employee not to testify is kind of a superpower, and it's really not. It all depends on the willingness of those individual employees to honor those requests.
So on the one hand, I've got my boss, the president, telling me not to testify, and probably the worst thing the president can do for me, do to me, is fire me, or as you say, give the order that I'm to be sidelined and sent to, count beans for the rest of my federal career. Though I may have some protections against that sort of retaliation. On the other hand, a congressional subpoena can result, if I don't follow it, in being held in contempt of Congress, for which I can be fined or even jailed. So maybe that explains some of it. I mean, certainly I'm not undermining or questioning the courage or patriotism of some of these people, but maybe they're making a reasoned decision that they'd rather defy their boss than defy a congressional subpoena.
Well, I think it's... assuming that they have, you know, good lawyers, and I assume that they all do, that they're having to pay out of pocket, by the way.
Yeah.
They're probably being
people
told,
like you are not cheap, are they?
I am very reasonably honest.
I'm sure you are. If ever Congress comes after me, Ben, you're my first call.
It's value for your money.
I'm sure it is.
But the ethics in government laws basically prevent government employees from accepting free or even significantly reduced legal fees from attorneys.
Wow.
They basically have to charge federal employees, current federal employees, full freight or nearly so. There's a few exceptions, but that's generally the case.
And so these people who are making this very difficult decision with the assistance of counsel, and by the way, I would strongly advise them to make it with the assistance of counsel, they might be facing severe financial distress because these are not rich people.
Absolutely.
And many of them have children in college or heading toward college, or they have mortgages. Northern Virginia real estate is not cheap. And so this could be an enormous financial stress for most of these people.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think that for the most part, anyone who's going up there to testify is probably incurring easily tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees.
And maybe significantly more.
Assuming they're getting good legal advice, they may be told that actually the threat of contempt from Congress is a little bit attenuated by the fact that Congress, in most instances, goes through the executive branch to prosecute those contempt citations. And in this case, the executive branch obviously would not be friendly towards those requests from Congress.
So the decision's not all that clear in terms of just the self-interest of the government employee. So that returns us to your original construct. It sounds like these people are acting out of dedication to the country and dedication to the truth.
I think that's the case, yeah.
And by and large, correct me if I'm wrong, but the press accounts that I've read suggest that most of the evidence has corroborated the initial transcript and the initial whistleblower complaint that brought the transcript to the attention of the public and Congress, Indeed, there seems to be an enormous amount of corroboration, up to and including the idea that the president was demanding for months before the July conversation, demanding a quid pro quo.
That seems to be the case. I mean, I think probably the best testimony to look at on that, probably the most succinct is and well-written is that of Bill Taylor, who is the chargé d'affaires at the embassy in Kiev, who gave a really amazing chronology of what he witnessed.
Yep, and I note that he was represented by John Bellinger, an almost classmate of mine in college, who has had a distinguished career in the federal government. And I believe that both Mr. Bellinger and the ambassador were referred to as human scum about the time of this testimony. Wasn't that the phrase the president used?
I think it was.
Yeah, the next time I speak to John, I'll have to address him as human scum.
It's really the kind of phrase that you only really hear in dictatorship.
I've never heard it before this point. I don't mean to make light of it, but it's just, I mean, this is further and further down the rabbit hole. Okay, one particular witness who is apparently testifying today, and this is the one that really gets me, is a fellow by the name of Alexander S. Vindman. And Vindman is a lieutenant colonel in the Army who is now testifying, if things have gone as according to plan today, maybe even as we speak, testifying in defiance of the order of the President of the United States. And now you have a military officer defying his own chain of command, an offense for which he can be court-martialed. It seems to me that this guy is probably taking the greatest risk of any witness who's yet to appear in front of Congress.
It really is an amazing situation, as is the criticism that he's receiving, completely groundless, as far as I can tell, about his loyalties to the country.
He is a guy who has proven himself in military service over a period of decades and has served with distinction, especially with regard to the country of his forebears. His family came from Ukraine, so apparently he's fluent in both Ukrainian and in Russian and has been an extremely important player in negotiations with Ukraine. And has been very much aware of the military situation there, which it probably behooves us to at least briefly acknowledge. Ukraine was invaded by Russia back, I think, in 2014, and the Russians still hold not only the Crimea, but a significant portion of eastern Ukraine. There's still a hot war going on there. The Ukrainians are obviously overmatched. The Ukrainians are obviously fighting for their national existence, and it's that sort of situation that they find themselves in, and we've been giving them a lot of military aid to protect them and to protect their freedom and to, of course, serve our own interests in Europe, where Russian expansion does not help us and does not help NATO. And it was that crucial aid, hundreds of millions of dollars worth, authorized by Congress, that the president was allegedly withholding in order to get the Ukrainian president to publicly announce that he was launching these two investigations, one about the server and one about the Bidens. And the information that's been coming out is that there's absolutely no evidence of either of those things. One wonders if the president simply wanted the announcement of the investigation so that he could use it to smear his opponents, even though there's ultimately nothing there.
Well, that's certainly what Bill Taylor's written testimony highlights, is that his interest was not in having these issues investigated. It was having statements made by the president of Ukraine that these issues were being investigated, and having those statements made on CNN, which Trump could point to as a more neutral news source. It's hard to describe this as like digging up dirt on the Bidens, when really what he was looking for was something to hang the political dirt that he was going to fling at Joe Biden on, really having nothing to do with the facts.
What makes it plausible is the entire Hillary Clinton email brouhaha, lost in all of the roiling developments of the Ukraine inquiry, is the fact that the State Department quietly issued on a Friday afternoon its ultimate findings of its investigation of the Clinton email scandal, and there was no scandal. There were some individual circumstances where perhaps some individual State Department employees shouldn't have sent an email or shouldn't have used their individual email addresses to do so. But nothing classified was revealed, and the State Department found that there was no systematic effort to violate the law. So, in other words, there was nothing to the Hillary Clinton email scandal other than her own admitted carelessness, which she regretted. But there was very little there, but that was an extremely potent thing for the president to, or the candidate, back in the 2016 election to keep hammering on.
Yeah, I think, you know, without relitigating the 2016 election, I think it's fair to say that it was obvious, it's obvious to everybody, the value of that kind of talking point to denigrating a Democratic opponent. And I think that's exactly what Trump was looking for in this case.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see what happens over the next days and weeks. As I've mentioned before, we're speaking on October the 29th, 2019. Things may very well change by the time this episode is broadcast, certainly by the time it's posted as a podcast. And so we apologize if it's dated by the time you're listening to it, dear listeners. And we didn't even have a chance to talk about the fact that there are criminal investigations that seem to be creeping closer to Rudolph Giuliani. And that may very well be another point of attack for the president's opponents. We haven't talked about the phony emoluments clauses, but there's just not enough time to talk about all of the stuff that's going on out there. But I do think that you've illuminated, certainly for me, what's going on with the primary Ukraine inquiry and the testimony that's happening right now. And so I think at least I am going to go forward and be able to appreciate more what's happening on a daily basis. So thank you, Ben Vernia, for your insights.
Well, you're welcome. I regret to say that we're living in interesting times.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Benjamin Vernia, former federal prosecutor and current lawyer in Washington, D.C. You know, Ben's also a high school classmate of mine, and while I don't think he was very smart back then, I think maybe he's picked up a few IQ points over the past few decades. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and before I go, let me remind you that while we certainly are first and foremost a public radio show produced at WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee, we are also a podcast. So you can find us on iTunes, you can find us on Spotify, you can find us on all sorts of podcast aggregation websites. And of course, you can also visit us on Facebook and on Twitter. And you probably will even find a few videos. If you Google us, simply Google Your Weekly Constitutional, you'll come up with all sorts of interesting stuff. And as you do so, remember, you are a part of the American experiment.